Good afternoon and welcome everyone to the Superfund Research Program Funding Opportunities Web Seminar, sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program. I will be the technical moderator for this webinar. We will get started in just a few moments. While we wait for others to log on, I would like to cover a few housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to this seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session as well as a list of the presenters for today's webinar. Please note the presenters' email addresses are hot linked on that page in case you have any questions after today's presentation. For those of you joining us via the phone lines, your phones were placed on mute when you joined the call. We will have a question and answer session at which point you can take your phones off mute. We ask that phone participants keep their phones on mute during the question and answer session unless you are asking a question. To unmute your phones during the question and answer session, you will need to dial *7. You may also need to press your phone's mute button if you previously put yourself on mute. After you ask your question, please put your phone back on mute by pressing *6 or by using your phone's mute button. Once again, use *6 to mute your phone and *7 to unmute. This will greatly reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. By now, those of you participating via the phone lines should have the presentation open and should be on slide 1. All of those participating via the internet should have clicked on the Go To session icon near the bottom of the page and should be on slide 1 of the presentation. As explained on slide 2, the main page contains the slides above which you will find navigation icons. Internet participants may submit questions by using the question mark icon you see above the slide and need not wait until the question and answer period to submit a question. In fact, we encourage you to submit a question in advance of the question and answer session. Also, if you experience any technical difficulties with the audio stream, you can use the question mark icon to alert us to the technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include a telephone number where we can reach you, and we will try to help you troubleshoot the problem. The presenters will be announcing the number of the slide to which they are moving. You may advance to the next slide by using the single right arrow located above the slide or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. At the end of the presentation, we will walk you through our links page where we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentations. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. In the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. Past web seminars are available on the CLUIN website and are also accessible via iTunes by searching for Superfund Research Program, which will take you to the Hazardous Waste Cleanup Information or CLUIN archives. With that, we are ready to start the session. Once more, I would like to remind phone participants to keep your phones on mute. And again, please do not put us on hold. I would now like to turn the time over to Dr. William Sook, the director of the Superfund Research Program at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. Go ahead, Dr. Sook.
Okay, thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes, just fine. Thank you. Go ahead.
Good. Well, first of all, I want to welcome you all to the Superfund Research Program Funding Opportunity Web Seminar. I'm Bill Sook. I'm director of this program, and I want to thank you for participating, and we see this as an opportunity to reach out to potential grantees, answer questions about the program, and provide contact information for future questions. Let me go to the next, the next slide. No, number two. No, number three. All right, well, that's kind of different. I'll just wing it. I noticed that from the folks who have called in that we have over 100 registrants into this, and some of them are new to the program, and I hope that you find it enjoyable. And those that have been around for a while, who are well-versed in the program, I hope you find it equally rewarding. We've designed this series of presentations to provide a little something for everyone, highlighting the different nuts and bolts of the... go back one slide again. Just go back one slide.
Slide two?
Yeah, just
right there.
That's good. Tell people what slide to be on. Okay, we're on slide three right now. So I'm just going to go through some things right here and give you some. This is a ballpark idea about what we're going to be covering in the program. So first of all, I want to say that this is a very competitive program. It's competitive in a number of different ways. We're going to be covering two aspects of the program. One has to do with the small business, SBIR, Small Business Innovative Research Program, and the other is the much more complicated multi-project centers program that we support as well. So it's going to be a real, it is a complicated program to be able to respond to, but it is a very rewarding program. So I'd like to take just a moment to tell you that I'm not the only one in this room. Also in this room is Heather Henry, Danielle Carlin, Beth Anderson, Lisa Edwards from Grants Management, Michelle Vitrino. I got that wrong. From Grants Management, Leroy Worth, who will be running the review, and Ed Pulp, Edward Pulp, from our program as well. So next slide, I think. No, I'll leave that right there. This is different than what I was saying. All right. So our plan today is to provide a brief overview of the SRP itself, our recent strategic plan, and then describe current funding opportunities, both in terms of the science that we would like for you to consider, but also with regards to the application process and the review process. We'll then have some time for some questions at the end, but essentially we're going to cover two funding mechanisms that we support. One is the, as I mentioned, the SBIR, or the Small Business Innovative Research Program, or the Technology Transfer Research Grants, STTR, which fund innovative remediation and detection technologies as part of the ongoing funding opportunities that's open to U.S. small businesses. They use the NIH activity codes, an R41 or an R44. And then we're going to go into a considerable amount of detail on the multi-project center grants, or the P42. This is a unique mechanism at NIH. It is a multi-project structure that allows for the integration across disciplines that are particularly biomedical and non-biomedical in areas. The intent is to be able to address, next slide, slide four. There we go. Now I'm back on track. Our four mandates. Now, I'm not going to read this to you. I'm just going to tell you that in 1986, NIEHS was authorized under the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, or SARA, to establish a research program to address these four mandates. And basically, the areas are to look at the assessing, evaluating, and detecting exposures and the effects of those exposures on human health, as well as the development of chemical, biological, and physical means to reduce the amount and or toxicity of hazardous substances. All the funding that we do under this program is consistent with, these four mandates. So, to address our program's mandates, we have the SBIR program that I mentioned,
and specifically the multi-project program, the P42 Centis program, all which are submitted through U.S. universities. However, we encourage folks to collaborate with other areas of the federal government, nonprofit organizations, for-profit organizations, and other academic institutions, including foreign institutions. Next slide. Slide five, sorry. Okay, here we go. So in addition to our mandates, our program is guided by our strategic plan, which is completed, the last one was completed in 2010, and it stresses our continued dedication to program relevance and identifies our key stakeholders as the Superfund programs at the US EPA and ATSDR, the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, which is a part of CDC, as well as other entities responsible for sites impacted by hazardous substances and the communities living near these sites. We are also, the strategic plan also highlights the importance of the research to achieve an impact and promote innovation to address the four mandates, but also to encourage or involve students, which make up the support of the next generation of scientists to address these very complex issues. So during today's presentation, I encourage you to consider how to design meritorious scientific studies that are relevant to the program, relevant to our key stakeholders, and can be used to make informed decisions with regards to risk and or remediation of hazardous substances. Everything that I've said and everything that is on here can be found on our web, and I hope that you have managed and looked at the web prior to participating in this webinar. It will provide you with a very good understanding, an excellent understanding, in fact, about the history of the program, how it came about, and where we intend on going. I'm now going to pass this off to Heather Henry, who will introduce the SBIR and the P42 grant opportunities. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in to today's talk. We do realize that there's quite a diversity of you out there, different levels of familiarity with the NIH, with NIEHS, and with the Superfund research program. So we've tried to tailor this so that it meets everybody's needs. What you'll find is that a lot of our slides contain all of the information that is really essential to understanding what the different funding mechanisms are about. However, I won't actually read all of that material, so it's here as a resource for you. What we'll try to do instead is highlight the real key points that, you know, are sort of nuances about applying for all of these types of applications for research funding. So I do want to point out, for those of you who are logged on, there is a little question, a question icon on the top of your screen. And what we'd really like to handle your questions that come up. It's kind of difficult to do it as we're talking and as we're presenting, just because of the limitations of the screen that we're working from. But if you do have a clarifying question, if there's something that we said that's unclear, go ahead and hit that button and let us know, and we'll try to address it as we're going through the slides. You can submit those questions at any time. It's just that unless it's a clarifying question, we might just wait until the end for the live question session before we address those. So again, there's that little question mark icon towards the top of your screen, and you can use that to submit questions at any point, but we're probably only going to be able to handle the clarifying questions as we go. So again, as Dr. Sook mentioned, I'm going to be introducing the SBIR, the Small Business Innovative Research Opportunities within NIEHS. And again, I realize a lot of you might have tuned in for the multi-project P42 application, but I hope you'll find this interesting as well. This is open to, as you'll see, the Small Business Innovative Research is open to small businesses, and it's meant to stimulate federal, or it's meant to stimulate product development, research and development from proof of concept to get new products into the marketplace. And while the Small Business Innovative Research is meant specifically for small businesses, the Small Business Technology Transfer Research requires a certain percentage, I believe it's 40%, partnership with nonprofits such as research institutions. So it could possibly even be an opportunity for those university researchers who have tuned in for the P42 discussion as well. And so the federal government sets aside a certain percentage of any resources of resources that go towards funding of research, and that's meant to go towards the private sector. So that's what these grants are a part of. The Superfund Research Program, we fund, as the title of the slide says, we fund the Hazardous Substances Detection and Remediation Program. And if you'll go to the next slide, it's probably not very surprising, but the two topic areas that we cover under these SBIR and STTRs are detection and remediation technologies. And we really encourage applicants to introduce new approaches to detection and remediation using biotechnology, nanotechnology, and bioengineering. And we really emphasize sustainable technologies. We just want to point out, too, that resources are limited for this amount, for this funding opportunity. We only invest $1.3 million in this whole program per year. So we really place a priority on technologies that are applicable to the Superfund, RISRA, and remediation as well as monitoring needs. We do have a topics of interest website, and I've provided that there. And just to give you a little background about how an SBIR and STTR work, these are done in two phases. And the first phase establishes technical feasibility of a technology. After that's successfully completed, then that allows an investigator to go back for a phase two award and provide further research and development, and also requires a commercialization plan for that phase two. So that's very important. While phase one might have a good idea, phase two, you really need to understand the commercial landscape and make a very convincing case for how your new technology really competes well with what's already out there. So there are three receipt dates that I've listed here, and then I've also included a text box that shows the suggested time and money allotments for each of the different programs. So next slide, go to slide 8. And all of the information that you would need is found in the program announcement, and I've included the links here. And I just want to point out that this is true for everyone, but there are review criteria that are clearly listed in the program announcement. It's very important to read that. In addition, all the information about how to apply, when to submit, who to submit your application to is all found in the program announcement. So I don't want to go into any details there, but if there are any questions, you're welcome to contact me about that. And then I do want to note that in order to submit an application, you must be registered within NIH's grant system. And as you noted, April 5th would be the next receipt date. So this process of getting registered in the NIH system takes about 4 weeks. So be sure by March you've gotten yourself registered in the system. So this is true for all funding mechanisms, but we find that the small businesses are not always already registered, whereas our university applicants generally are already registered and don't need to worry about that. So when applying, you don't need to send what's called a letter of intent. But we do encourage applicants to contact program staff. So someone like me, I'm happy to answer your questions and make sure that the research you're proposing is the kind of research that we're looking for, because obviously that helps you down the road in terms of funding possibilities. And then I did want to let you know a little, another little tip is that if when you submit your application, if you include a cover letter, you can not only mention that you intend to be a part of this NIEHS Hazardous Substances Detection and Remediation Program, but you can also specify the review study section that you want. And that's a good idea because your remediation and detection technology may be a little bit different than the typical biomedical research that NIH reviews, and so it can really help you if you are in the right study section. And then there are lots of notices that NIH puts out. One of those notices is that when you submit an application, it absolutely needs to be correct by the end of the day on the due date. It used to be that there were some error correct. A two-day error correction window that allowed you, even if, you know, for some reason when you upload your electronic application, you could go back 2 days later and fix it, but that no longer exists. So it's very important, if you can get your application in early, to please do that. And so if you could turn to slide 9, another tip we have for potential applicants is to have a look at who we currently fund. And so we've provided a screenshot here on slide 9, as well as a link to our currently funded SBIR and STTR grantees. And slide 10 is our contact slide. So I'm the primary contact for the Superfund Hazardous Substance Detection and Remediation Program, so I've listed my information there. And we figured much of the clue-in audience, due to the EPA remediation and cleanup technologies, those of you out there are probably going to be most interested in that program. But I did want to let you know that NIEHS does have two other programs for SBIR and STTR. One is more biomedical oriented, and Dan Shaughnessy would be the contact person there. And then he's on the left, and then on the right at the bottom is Ted Outwater, and he works on small business opportunities for worker education and training, and that's by solicitation only. Slide 9 is blank. Somebody had a comment that slide 9 was blank.
Working on.
Sorry, Sue, we seem to have, we see that there's a slide 9, but these slides will be available afterwards, and so we can make sure that you get those on the archive. Are there any other questions that should be addressed? Okay, great. So we didn't see any online questions submitted. So.
No, there are.
There are?
Wait, let's wait.
Okay, no clarification.
For SBIR.
Okay, great. So at this point, I know that was a rapid overview, but again, I'm really happy to answer questions offline and at the end of the T42 discussion. So without too much ado, let's move on to slide 11. And we'd like to shift gears to talk about the center grants, which is, it's a unique NIH mechanism assigned to the Superfund Hazardous Substance Research and Training Program. So if you ever see a P42, it will only ever be associated with the Superfund Center program. And the goal of the P42 centers ultimately is to provide public health through integrative research, providing sound science to inform the ongoing risk assessment and remediation management activities that occur at the numerous hazardous waste sites across the country. So our hope, the reason that the program was put together in the way that it is to bring the expertise of health and environmental researchers together to address the intractable issues facing Superfund. So we've listed some of our major interests or our major goals in the purple, blue, and green boxes there. The program seeks to improve public health, to provide science, data, and information and knowledge to stakeholders, and also to bring the expertise of biomedical and non-biomedical researchers together. So we feel that this holistic approach is what will really make a difference to stakeholders. And if we could move to slide 11. We work on many, slide 12, thank you. We have many different versions of a concept of the P42 center, but what we mean to get across here is that we intend to use biomedical and non-biomedical research and training approaches to really target a specific problem. And we feel like those problems that are being that our stakeholders, whether that's EPA, the ATSDR, community engagement, or communities who are affected by hazardous substances, that they're all addressing, that they're dealing with problems that really require basic research in order to answer the questions and help us find solutions to reduce exposures. And so that's really the point of these P42 centers, is to really bring together all of the types of research, whether it's biomedical, but also non-biomedical and ecological and geological research, to address a particular problem and come up with solutions for those problems. So next slide, 13. So the scope of the program is actually quite broad, and it derives from our mandates, which you've already seen before when Dr. Sook was talking. These are listed to the right in orange. We've always stressed relevance to the National Superfund program, which is managed by our sister Superfund agencies at the U.S. EPA and ATSDR, and that was also part of our strategic plan, which Dr. Sook also spoke about. And the strategic plan, I just want to point out, also mentioned our interest in transdisciplinary research and forward-looking research, and because we see these as a mechanism to achieve innovation. And so we just want to give you some guidance in fashioning the scope of your proposal. So on the left column, the box is there. We just want you to keep in mind that while the scope is broad, there should be a clear link to the Superfund research program, and that being our mandates and the strategic plan. And we've provided a list of suggested research topics, which are available on our website, and also we'll provide more information about how to find those. But these suggested research topics give a good idea about the type of problems that the EPA and ATSDR stakeholders are looking for solutions, and it's a great way to find out what kind of research that your university or your center can pull together to address these questions. And then we also do encourage you to look at our current grantees. We don't want a mirror image of research that we're already funding. So we do encourage you to have a look and see who we're currently funding and try to complement existing research as much as possible. And just a real important point that we want to emphasize is that work on Superfund sites is certainly not required, even RCRA sites. We're not a site-specific program. And the purpose is because we want the results from this program to be generalizable to many sites and many scenarios where there might be exposures to hazardous substances. So please move to slide 14. And we wanted to familiarize those of you who are newer to this center mechanism. Wanted to give you an idea about the required components. And in order to be responsive to the RFA, you need to have each of these components, so it's very important. But again, although it's shaped in a pie shape, I don't want you to lose the important detail that all of these projects and cores should be tied together and integrated under that unifying problem-solving theme that you've identified. So to the left in the green and lavender are the research projects, and we require a minimum of 2 biomedical and 2 non-biomedical, as well as an administrative core, research translation core, community engagement core, and training core. Right now, research support cores are optional. That's new this year. And in terms of budget limitations, new proposals are at 1.7 for 4 years, and renewal proposals are at 2.1 direct costs for 5 years. And the other limitation that we've put is that the total number of these projects and cores cannot exceed 12. So you're limited to, you're going to end up with a minimum of 8 due to all the required, but you're maxed out at 12. So there is some flexibility in terms of how many projects or whether or not you include a research support core. So next slide, please. And just give you a little more about the projects. They're standalone, have independent testable hypotheses. However, if it is more of an applied research project, you might find that it's perfectly acceptable for the project to have a logical progression of tasks as opposed to firmly stated hypothesis. I will say, however, that a hypothesis does tend to go over better in review, just as a tip. But basic to application-oriented is fine within the scope. And these projects should be integrated with one another. The RFA, we really look for integration between the biomedical and the non-biomedical, just because we feel like that's really going to drive impact in the real world. When you're talking about exposures to people and coming up with ways to reduce exposures, we feel that that's going to take a biomedical and a non-biomedical approach. Again, interactions between cores are very important. So the projects should not think of themselves as being isolated, but highly integrated with the training, community engagement, and the research translation core. And I'm going to say a little bit more about the research translation core in a couple slides. So next slide, please. This is slide 16. Just some tips. We really encourage centers to focus. These are lean times in terms of government funding, and it's not a bad idea to come in as lean as possible, both in terms of your requested budget, but also, you know, the number of research projects that you submit. And we think this is especially true for new centers, but we encourage researchers to really stay focused and not try to do too much with the center. You have a certain budget limitation and a 12-component limit, but it doesn't mean every application that comes in needs to go up to that level. We also remind applicants to have a really good editor with fresh eyes to make sure that all the interactions between the projects and cores are cross-referenced, just to make the point that different reviewers review different projects. And so it's really important that you're consistent throughout the entire application. And then speaking of the reviewers, our P42 reviewers, and we'll touch on this a little bit later, but they really represent a very broad spectrum of expertise. So we encourage investigators to consider writing their abstracts and titles in a language that is understandable for a skilled audience, but without your particular expertise in your field. And this is also in keeping with NIH policy. NIH is really trying to encourage researchers to do this in general, but we think it's probably even more important for the P42 applicants because, the review group is so diverse, and because the interactions between projects and cores are essential to get a really competitive score, it really behooves you that all of the reviewers are able to have an understanding of how the whole center fits together, and perhaps the language in the RFA and the language in the abstracts and the titles can really help you out there. So slide 17. So in an effort to stimulate investigators to explore opportunities for sharing research projects and to look for broad opportunities for research translation during project development, we have provided additional instructions this year for research sharing plans. And that's found in the RFA and is also a part of an associated notice that went out. It's in the purple box, ES12003, Clarification and Resource Sharing Plan. And so this resource sharing plan, the additional instructions, it doesn't replace the NIH policies about sharing of data, such as genome-wide association studies, but it does allow the researcher to identify avenues where data sharing and research translation opportunities exist. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail at this time, but I do want to make sure that you realize that in the application guidelines for the P42s, we do go into a lot of detail and provide links to ideas and suggestions for what to include in those. These are just one paragraph each, and it's just to be a plan. It's nothing to be set in stone per se. But we do encourage researchers to consider that and include that in their application. Page 18. We'll move on to the different cores. Again, on the left side, I've just provided bullets for those of you who are new to the P42s about what the functions of the admin core is and what it involves. But essentially, it's the executive branch of the program, and it provides structure to the multi-project grants. We did want to make sure that, the RFA details, the requirements and such, but if you focus on the boxes to the right, we just wanted to point out, a well-thought-out administrative core, it really breaks, you can see that there's a break between the silos of the disciplines, between the basic, more applied research, and it also creates an environment that encourages translation, and that's really what we want to see happening with the administrative cores. In addition, a really good administrative core, you'll see that, although it's not a requirement, but you'll see that they've really looked out for their mentoring of junior staff and trainees. And for some, and this is very important, if some of your researchers or senior researchers are to the point where they may be retiring soon, it's very important that there's a really good succession planning for the continuation of the center. If your center may be facing a transition period. So next slide, please. So slide 19 goes over the Research Translation Core, or sometimes we call it the RTC. And the purpose of the RTC is to communicate and facilitate the use of research findings coming from the program and to help advance the research objectives of that project in the program. So our Research Translation Core has four components, and all centers are required to have a plan for carrying out each of them. And so we've listed those four components: communication, government partnerships, technology transfer, and information dissemination. And so just a few points to make about this. SRP, our version of translation is not necessarily NIH's version, which tends to be more clinical, bench to bedside. So while that's certainly not excluded from our idea of research translation, we do see that the SRP research can go to many more avenues than just for biomedical research. And that's part of the reason why we have the government partnerships and technology transfer as being required components for having a plan. So we see instead the SRP's Research Translation Corps as an opportunity to have information go from center to center as well as from the center outward, so to all end users. And also as part of one of the responsibilities of the RTC is to communicate back to us, back to the Superfund Research Program, about the RTC activities. And so I've provided a website there that is how current grantees are reporting back to SRP, and that might be helpful for new applicants to know about. So slide 20. We just wanted to point out a couple things about one or two of the components. First, that being the communicating within SRP and sub-bullet A. And one of the responsibilities of the Research Translation Corps is to work with the investigators from each project and to come up with a plan for how that project, the products coming out of that project, can be translated. So it's really important when you're assembling your Research Translation Corps team that you have folks who have the required expertise who can communicate effectively, whether you're talking about the biomedical or non-biomedical science that your center represents. And again, that person should coordinate with investigators of each project, but might find that working with clusters of projects makes sense in terms of the translation of these of the products that come out of each of these projects. And we do recommend, as was mentioned previously, the research translation course coordinate with the projects when they write their researcher-initiated research translation paragraph of the data sharing plan. You certainly, in any case, you want to have consistency between projects and cores, but in particular, one would expect that there's been some communication between the research translation core leaders and the project investigators. And with regard to partnerships with government agencies, we just want to point out that we prioritize EPA and ATSDR, but we certainly don't require it, and we realize that they are not the only government agencies that may be the most appropriate for the research translation of your center. So we encourage you to visit our additional resources webpage. We have links there that would be helpful in initiating research translation activities if you're still searching for the right match for your researchers, particularly with regard to government agencies. And then lastly, just the information about, or the information dissemination to other end users. It's a recent change in the RFA, just a little bit of, a little bit different than it was in previous years. And this is essentially accomplishes the goal of what is kind of typically considered outreach. So that might help for those of you who are used to, and we're going to be talking about community engagement next, but those who are used to community outreach might find that those community outreach activities are actually more appropriate for this fourth bullet within Research Translation Core. And we can talk about that later if there are specific questions. So the community engagement core is on the next slide, slide 21. And our community engagement core serves the program by supporting and guiding communities and drawing from the science of the program. So this is a required core, and it's very important that bidirectional connections are made with the communities that are impacted with hazardous waste sites or impacted by other hazardous substances. And the RFA has a broad definition of target communities. Those impacted by sites contaminated with hazardous substances. So please, if you have any questions about that, let us know, and we can help you work with that and, work through that broad definition. But again, we just want to highlight the importance of the bidirectionality. There is a community engagement component statement, which is a one-page description of basically how you're achieving bidirectionality. So that is a good opportunity for you to make sure that this very important part of the community engagement core is included in your application. And like the RTCs, we recommend visiting the SRP additional resources webpage for community engagement information. And if we could move to the next slide. I need to pull up my and the next slide is slide 22. And I just wanted to give an opportunity to compare the research translation core with the community engagement core. They share a challenge, which is to find the most appropriate end user, as the case is for research translation, or the most appropriate community group, as the case would be for community engagement. And to link up these other individuals with the center's research and the center's activities. The research translation core provides information and byproducts from program to program as well as program outward to all end users. And the community engagement core is a bidirectional interaction with community group and program and the center. So at its best, a research translation core really helps to establish an iterative exchange between the stakeholders so that the program investigators find the right end user for the type of science that they're doing. And frequently, the end user can actually be a valuable resource, aiding the researchers as to how the to tweak their own research or their investigation in a way that really maximizes its eventual use in the real world. So we really encourage investigators to start these interactions early, even in the development of a research project, just to ensure that there's a better chance that the project will have an eventual impact. And so the other thing to point out is that it's not your imagination. The Research Translation Corps and the Community Engagement Corps can sometimes appear to be similar at times. I mean, they both are going to involve government activities at times. If the end user for a community is an organization, the Research Translation Corps may have a lot of outreach activities that go to this community as well, and so there's going to be some overlap and blurring. But as long as they're achieving the separate goals that are required for each of the corps, then this kind of overlap is really, truly okay. It's acceptable. And I just wanted to point out that Beth Anderson is here in the room, and she is the lead in research translation and community engagement for the Superfund Research Program, and so she'll be here to answer specific questions as they come up at the end of the presentation. So let's move on to slide 23. These are the training core. It's relatively straightforward. It's meant to provide graduate level and cross-disciplinary training, and so the trainees that we're really targeting are graduate students and postdoctoral researchers. And this core is now required, which is this is the first time in a while that training has been required. So we want to make sure that applicants are aware of that. So we've listed some of the activities that are very important in the pink box. And on the right, we just want people to know that it really comes up a lot of times in review for returning programs. They just want to know what happened to the past trainees, what are their successes, what is your recruitment plan. And so we encourage people to provide that information because it is a curiosity that the reviewers have in terms of understanding the success of prior training programs. And also in the room is Dr. Danielle Carlin, and she leads the training corps activities, and so she'll be here at the end if anyone has questions about that specifically. And so the next slide, 24, is the Research Support Corps, which now is an optional corps, and they're meant to support a particular research function that are shared between at least two projects. So that might be analytical work, data analysis, could be technology-driven, might be human subjects or animal care facilities. What's new this year is that these support corps are optional. So in consideration on the cap of the number of projects and corps, we decided to allow centers the option whether to include research support corps since many universities have core facilities at their disposal. But we do, however, encourage corps to be included in centers. They're excellent for stimulating interactions between projects, and a good core really serves to integrate the entire program. And this is a key review component, again, the integration of the entire program and center. So if you choose not to include a research support core, we really encourage the projects themselves that they should adequately detail the research support activities, that is, to provide adequate QA and QC information, because that's something that reviewers will be looking for. So slide 24 is over, and we're going to look at slide 25. and so we just wanted to highlight some of the new things this year. Again, we've already talked about many of them. So again, components at 12, training is required. Research support corps are optional. And we have provided more instructions for the research sharing plan for projects. That's just for projects. Corps are welcome to include them, but they're not required to, or it's not meant to be for corps. And there are also some modifications in review criteria. Always look at the review criteria, but there have been a few more modifications than usual in the overall center description. as well as the descriptions of the cores. So please have a look at those. And moving on to slide 26, I apologize that I did gloss over on each of the cost limitations. I noted them on the previous slides, but I didn't mention them here. And I wanted to save all of the cost limitations for just this one slide. And first, you know, I did mention that for new applicants, we're capped at $1.7 million a year direct costs. That's a four-year limit. And for renewal applications, we're at $2.1 million direct costs per year. So out of that total amount, only 20% of that total direct cost can be dedicated towards the total of admin, research translation, community engagement, and training course. That's what's meant to be indicated in the pie graph above. So the other 80% must be for research projects and research support course. So each of the cores themselves also have limitations. If you add those other, it actually, if you add those together, it actually exceeds the 20% ceiling. So therefore, centers should really direct the funds as they're most needed within, you know, the way that you've set up your center and the activities of all of these cores. And just, you know, one hint that we just want to make sure that researchers are aware of, projects, they can include their research translation related activities in their budget. So if that's going to be a way that helps you balance the budget, we want to make sure that you consider that as an opportunity. And so let's move on to slide 27. Other recent changes, the research translation core, again, that there's a translation plan, just a plan for each project. There's the research strategy sections of the applications have gone down to a 12-page limit over the last couple of years. There's also been some changes in the review scoring system. Those of you who have been in the system for the last couple of years, it hasn't changed since then. Also, there's only one resubmission allowed for any applications. And again, there had been some changes in the community engagement over the last couple of years, but none. No significant changes in this current RFA on any of these items here. So, in other words, these items here were also in the previous RFA. And then just unchanged characteristics. Again, we are still not a site-specific program. We still do basic to application-oriented research, and we still highly value innovative approaches to research. So we do encourage people to think outside the box. And lastly, slide 28, we just want to highlight what we think is really critical for a successful P42. And incidentally, these are the key review criteria for the overall center. And that's we want to see projects and cores that are meritorious and as uniformly meritorious as possible. We want to see integration, interaction, and synergy, both between the biomedical and non-biomedical research, but also between the projects and cores. We want to see everybody working together to address a very important problem, and we want to see that these problems are going to aid stakeholders for effective science-based decision-making. So again, these are really important overall things to consider for a successful P42 center, because these are really what are what reviewers are going to be looking for the overall center. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Wirth, who will talk about the reviews segment. And that takes us to slide 29.
Thanks, Heather. I, as Heather mentioned, I'm Roy Wirth, and I'm the science review officer. I will be coordinating this review for 2012. And the review meeting, this will not work. Oh, sorry. Also, want to make sure you're giving it to the. Yeah, that's okay. Want to make sure that everyone knows that I will be carrying out the review in late October of some time. In the interest of time, we're almost at 3 o'clock. I will just spend the next 5 to 10 minutes just illustrating some issues relative to how the review process.
hope we are on now. We on slide 30, which is the
start
people.
Over.
Yes. Okay. Just so the interest, I want to make, I will start back over it. Lost the interest of time. I'm Leroy Worth. I'm the scientific review officer for the P42 applications. For this round, the review will take place in middle to late October. It's usually the standard time that these applications get reviewed. And the next slide, which will be slide 30, I don't know if I was on that one already. This is the timeline in terms of the review process. We want to get letters of people intending to submit to the P42 application, application for this round, that they get their letters of intent in by March 12th, 2012. March 11th, I think, is on a Sunday, isn't it?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. At March 12th, just as long as you get them in, that'd be great. I see they've lost my audio. Okay, receipt our applications is due on April 10th, 2012. At that time, about 4 weeks after that, about a month after receiving all the applications, there will be an admin review. And at this review, we look for responsiveness of the applications. And those that are deemed responsive, we look at certain criteria to make sure that all the components are associated with your particular application. And if that all is satisfied, those will go to review. Those that aren't considered responsive, you will be notified along with your office sponsored program that the application has been on 901 and be returned. And again, you want to make sure that you follow the instructions and guidelines as illustrated in the RFA and as Heather alluded to earlier. Again, with these P42 applications that get submitted, we like to have those letters. In these letters of intent, we want to make sure that you specify all the key personnel associated with it, titles of all the projects that you intend to submit, and get that to us in a succinct manner along with the overall intent of the P42 application. Again, this is used to help me try to orchestrate the review prior to actually getting submission of the applications. I usually have to do these. For each round, we usually average between 70 to 100 reviewers that I have to bring together, and depending on the areas of expertise, it could be a little larger, a little smaller. But on average, we're talking about 80 to 90 reviewers for each round. So it behooves you to get these letters in to make sure that the proper expertise can be recruited. And again, we'd like to get the expertise illustrated in that letter because we want to make sure I can deal with conflicts. Again, the peer review will take place late fall in October, and in that process, we discuss the application. Next slide. And as I illustrated, I won't go through the letters of intent. I went through about addresses and key personnel. The LOIs, again, it's not March 16th. This is last year. But this March 12th, 2012. Next slide. That's slide 32. In terms of, as I mentioned earlier, with these, there's a broad spectrum of applicants that come in, and with that, there's a lot of areas of expertise that I usually have to recruit. And here, just to illustrate that, we can see that we get toxicology, epidemiology, bioinformatics, epigenetics, and genetics. And compared to biology, we get all that along with non-biomedical expertise in geology, ecology, ecotox, biofilm, microbiology. I don't need this. What's that?
So they're hearing you they're hearing you twice with a slight delay. So.
Oh, okay. I want to try to take care of that. I wonder if the other one's close. Hopefully we can hear better now. And along with that, we get community outreach and folks in terms of expertise for these committees. Next slide. Yeah, that is probably going to make sure there's no feedback. In terms of P42 applications, when we get them in, there is a two, I don't want these mixed up relative to two levels of review. Two levels of review of what happened or what happens to an application when it comes in. First level review is what I take care of. The second level review is when it goes to
our advisory board. But here, in terms of the actual application going to review in late October, I lost my slide. We have a two-phase process in terms of review of each application. In the first phase of each application that comes up that's considered highly meritorious, we will discuss the individual projects, and it usually follows with project one, project two, project three, project four. That's the minimum was considered responsive. We've got two biomedical and two non-biomedical. And then we go into the cores, usually admin cores, facility cores, if there are any facility cores, and community outreach and research translation, as Heather alluded to. All those are actually scored. They get an impact score, and it's based on criteria scores for the research projects. And with the research projects, we have, next slide, let me get this, 34. We have these illustrated here in terms of project impact score. We deal with the five criterion elements, and that's significance, innovators, investigators, innovation, approach, and environment. What you should know is when we went on the enhanced peer review, that the process in terms of these criterion scores, they were actually weighted, and investigators and approach were actually switched, so there's more weight in terms of the impact or significance of your study and expertise that you have, along with how innovative approach and environment are not as important, but you want to make sure that you do cover these areas. With the impact scores, they're scored between 1 and 9, and they actually end up, when you get your summary statements, they will be between 10 and 90. They actually get multiplied by 10. And the way these are weighted is based, usually I always tell people that you, they aren't an average of the individual criterion scores, but your impact score will be how those individual criterion scores were weighted. And depending on if the approach, actually if everything else was in the 10, which is the exception for outstanding range, if you get something like your approach is in the 4 to 5 range, you get an overall score of 40, then you can tell they weighted the approach over everything else. So you want to make sure you kind of look at your individual criterion scores. Do not try to average those, but actually look at your overall impact score relative to your individual critique for that particular project. Next slide is slide 35, and this is core impact scores. And this, again, is separate from the research cores, which is the biomedical and non-biomedical. But here you have the administrative research translation core, community engagement and training, and research support cores. And these have their own individual elements that they will use to, in terms of criterion. They aren't, won't follow in terms of the project cores, and they're specific. So we want to make sure when you read the RFA and see what will be used in terms of evaluating that particular core. I want you to make sure you pay attention to that relative to the RFA. And these also receive impact scores between 10 and 90. Next slide, which will be slide 36, is actually it was the second phase, which you, now you, after the committee has discussed individual projects, they'll come back and they'll discuss the whole application. And in this, they're looking at merit of the individual projects and cores as a whole. They're looking at, as Heather had alluded, looking at integration across projects and how the biomedical and the non-biomedical are integrated, looking for synergy, and looking at how each one of these projects fit in terms of contributing to the overall mission of the center. So when you're writing these, you want to make sure that you have this overall arching theme of how these projects go to a common goal. And then the final overall impact score, again, will be between 10 and 90, and that basically will show you how, you, again, you would not want to go ahead and average all the individual projects and cores to get this overall impact score. That overall impact score would actually direct your attention of what the issues of what they really liked about the application or what they didn't like about an application in terms of the center. Next slide. This is slide 37. Thanks for telling me that. This is just looking at the centers. I won't spend too much time on this. Heather actually alluded to this, and I just briefly hit this earlier. in terms of emphasis on integration and the language. You want to make sure that you're broad in terms of the overall expertise. I think one of the questions was dealing with previous progress reports. Those will be provided in the introduction, and you want to make sure that that's provided for those that are continuing. And in terms of highlights, you want to then explain how all this individual parts contribute to the center. Next slide. In terms of reviewer's perspective, this is slide 38. You want to make sure you seek appropriate advice in, when you're putting these applications together. Always make sure that you also check the literature. In terms of when we start to evaluate these, and we don't really compare applications, but you want to see you, the way you make your application stand out, you want to really look for impact. And so you want to know where you are in terms of literature, what you're studying. You also want to make sure that if it's most things in terms of these are factorial in terms of more than one aspect that's being considered. You want to make sure you're up to date on the literature for each aspect that you are providing in that application, because that is where the impact will be recognized. Make sure you're, again, organized according to the guidelines. And, again, we always tell you to write with reviewer in mind. I always tell people to write it in terms if your mother was going to read it, or father for that matter. You want to keep it in layman's terms, but for the most part, if you're looking at the individual specific aims, that's where you're catered to the actual expertise in your area of study. Discuss accomplishments, potential pitfalls, alternate approaches. That all should be included. You want to be, as Dr. Sook alluded earlier in the, one of the first or second slides, you want to be very focused in terms of how you orchestrate these applications. And again, don't assume reviewers know what you mean. Try to spell out as much as possible. I know there are restrictions in terms of page limitations, but you want to make sure you're very focused in terms of how you set up your application. These are just some notices. I just want to draw your attention to the second one. There was note in the guide OD 10-115 is enhanced peer review. Post-submission of application materials, this is left up to the discretionary of the SRO, which is me. I will accept supplemental materials. We ask that once a review date is set, that it would be 30 days prior to that, that I'll allow supplemental materials to be submitted. And I ask you to please look over this in terms of what is acceptable in terms of what you can submit, in terms of latest publications and stuff like that. That's one reason I always pretty firm component of allowing supplemental materials. A lot of SRs do not do this, but I prefer to have it. So if you are going to submit, make sure you get it in 30 days before the review date. And there are restrictions in terms of how much you can submit. It's usually 1 to 2 pages, but make sure that you get that into me and send that to me as a PDF. Next slide. Again, this is slide 40, components of successful application. Most of you all already know this. This is not one of my slides, but it's in here. But you want to make sure you have a good idea and it's good science. And which, again, you want to make sure that you've done a thorough lit review and actually have carved out a niche and basically saying this is of high impact. Okay, with that, I will turn it over to budget. And if there are any questions or anything like that, you can click submit so we can see those and we'll.
Hi, I'm Lisa Edwards, and I'm going to be very brief. Now that you've already know what the science is and you know what the reviewers are looking for, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what to expect for your budget. And so I'm going to start with slide 42. The P42s are still paper format, so they must be submitted following the PHS 398 guidelines. The SBIRs and STTRs are electronic, so you want to make sure that you're using the latest versions of any form or the latest electronic version if you're submitting for the SBIR or STTR. You also want to make sure at the time that you submit your application that you are preparing for any approvals that may take place, your ICOC, your RRB, begin working on your other support. Make sure that none of your investigators that are considered key are listing zero, varies, or as needed as effort for any of their projects on other support, because that is not acceptable. They also must equal 12 calendar months or 100% of their total time, and that's time devoted to the grant. It does not matter what the salary is, but it's the time devoted to the grant. Please also note when you are preparing these that there is a new revised grants policy statement, and those that NOT is listed here, that you should use that as your reference and guidelines. Also, the salary cap right now is up in the air, so the latest one is still posted, but please keep an eye on that in the next couple of days. That may be changing. I'll move on to slide 43. And this budget preparation, you just want to make sure that your parent grant direct costs, the considerations for any out years, the equipment is usually a one-time thing. You want to make sure that you justify anything beyond the first year. Subcontracts, they must also have a budget, and those budgets should follow immediately behind the parent grant project or core that it is related to. Please don't put all your subcontract budgets together at the end of the proposal. That's not how they should be. They should be directly behind each project or subcore that it relates to. And you should have the form pages 4 and 5 for your subcontracts as well as your parent grant. Also remember that the F&A for your subcontracts is not included in your direct cost cap. That Heather has already given you your cost limitations on slide 26, so you want to make sure that you relate to that and not go over that, because that is the reason a grant can get sent back or not reviewed, because they are not meeting the budget guidelines. Your budget justification, please make sure that all costs are itemized. The most trouble that we have is personnel. You change effort in personnel in out years, and that information is not justified, and we will hold them at the 2% escalation. Moving on to slide 44. This only applies to the P42 budget. It is a non-modular budget, meaning that it is detailed. You have to have budget page form page 4 and 5 for all projects, all cores, and for all your third party or your subcontracts. All the budgets should be put together again in part 1 of the application, and all budget pages should be labeled at the top. Following page 44 are some examples of what the budget pages should look like. A change in the escalation cost, NIH is now only allowing a 2% escalation for any reoccurring costs in out years. So please, if you put in 3%, it's going to get marked down to 2%. Anything above the 2% escalation must be justified. If it's not clearly justified, then it will be held at the 2%. Also, please be mindful that NIEHS expects you to provide funds to travel individuals to the annual meeting. Most of these costs are coming out of your administrative core, where your PI, the business manager, and 4 students should be in attendance at the annual meeting each year. We're also looking for the community engagement core budget leader and the research translation core budget leader. We expect to have some kind of information in your progress report the following year indicating who actually attended those meetings so that we will know that you were in compliance with this guideline. Moving on to slide 45 is just a sample of what the budget page would actually look like. Sorry, this is 46. And it just gives you a breakdown of what your composite budget page should look like. You should have the cost listed for all of your projects, all of your cores on the one page. And also notice at the bottom you have your consortia cost, and your consortia cost F&A is excluded from your direct cost total, but then there is a total direct cost which will include the F&A cost. But if when you relate this back to the face page, it will be listed correctly if you fill this form out correctly. Page 47 is just the overall composite budget for all years. Mine is off from yours. 48.
Okay. Okay. So thanks, Lisa. did you, were all your slides there?
Yeah.
Is there a slide missing?
It was all just form pages.
Okay.
Now we'll have Beth to Heather will talk to you again.
Yep. Yeah. So slide 48, just wanted to make sure you all have the link to the RFA announcement. That's the current P42 announcement on the street. We don't tend to change these very much during the year, so even if you're applying next year, really behooves you to have a look at this current RFA. Also, the notice came out that clarified resource sharing plans and also announced this webinar, so encourage you to look at the notice as well. And then again, just application details. There's only one application per institution. Letters of intent, as Leroy said, are actually due on the 12th of March. The due date for the whole application is April 10th. Scientific review we expect to be about October, and the award start date would be in April. And again, highly recommend consultation with staff. There's four program staff in our office, and we're at your command to set up a call and listen to you and find out what your interests are. These applications take a year and a half sometimes to put together, so it's really important to engage us early on in the process. We really encourage that. So slide 49, again, just to point out some of the resource web pages that we have set up for you on that on the RFA webpage, the application guidelines, the research topics, additional resources, and community engagement information. So that'll be very important for you, especially if you're just getting started. We also encourage you, again, to look at our list of current grantees. And so for page 50, I just want to show you our contact information. Dr. William Sook, Beth Anderson, myself, Heather Henry, Danielle Carlin. We're all part of the program staff. Danielle and I are primarily managing the applications at this point, and we'd probably be your primary contact person, especially for setting up meetings and such. We also have in our office Edward Pope, whose name, I'm sorry, was left off. He's giving me a look like I'm in trouble. Sorry about that. But he's also helping us behind the scenes quite a bit. And grants management, Lisa Edwards, who you just heard from, her contact information, and also Michelle Victolino. And then Dr. Leroy Wirth, who the way things work is that after an application is submitted, you would stop contacting Danielle and me or Bill, Beth, whatever the case is, and you would instead be in contact with Leroy, with Dr. Worth. So we also want to acknowledge Justin Crane and the folks at ClueIn who allowed us to use their online training software to have this webinar. And so at this point, we'll go on to slide 51, and we want to give you the opportunity to ask questions yourselves. And we've gotten a number of questions online already, and that's still the online submission of questions is still a great way to do it. However, if you would like to ask your question online or on the phone lines, what you do is you hit the *6 button to unmute your phone, and when you state your question, name your name, your organization, and then to unmute. To mute your phone again, you would hit *6. Is that still the case?
That's very close, Heather. It's
okay.
Star 7 to unmute and star 6 to mute.
Okay, star 7 to unmute?
Yep.
Correct.
And star?
6 to mute.
Star 6 to mute. Okay. So if you're looking at the 5, you have the wrong information in front of you. I apologize for that. So it's star 7 to unmute and star 6 to mute your phone line. So, like I said, we've gotten a number of questions online. So what I'd like to do at this point is field a couple of those questions. And while we're doing that, really encourage those of you who are on the phone line to get up the courage to take your phone off mute. And to do that, you would press star 6, or no, star 7. So we'll start with a question that came in about slide 34. This is from Teresa Horton from Northwestern University, and she wanted to have clarification on slide 34. She said, I missed the speaker's comment about the reordering of the priorities of significance, investigator, innovation, approach, and environment. Is the current order as shown on the slides, or have investigator and innovation switched places? So again, this is about slide 34.
Yeah, where's it?
Yeah, this is in reference to the enhanced peer review. What you see on the slide is actually correct, but what I was trying to allude to is the fact that prior to 2 years ago, it was significance, approach, innovation, investigators, environment. But after the enhanced review, peer review, those switched, but the order you see there is the correct order.
Thanks, Leroy.
Yep.
And another question came in from Bruce Stanton from Dartmouth Medical School, and he asked, please clarify where the progress report should be presented within each P42 project core. And I think what we're interpreting from this question is that you want to know where you can provide a narrative describing the progress of the project and core and of the overall center. And so I would refer you to guidelines, the application guidelines on pages 8 and 9. For renewal applications, you would list your general progress in section 2, which is part of the center's introduction.
Right.
This also is included as part of the 12-page limit for the center introduction. There's also an opportunity for projects and cores in their own descriptions to provide a narrative statement about their progress. That goes into the research plan, but it's actually a one-page introduction that precedes the specific aim, so it doesn't count against the 12 pages, the 12-page limit of your research strategy. So again, for projects and cores, as part of a renewal application, they would describe the narrative about the progress of their project and core in the introduction to the application, which is a one-page summary that precedes the rest of the description of the project and core. So hopefully, Bruce, that answers your question. And I'm going to pass it off to Beth, who has a couple of questions that came in.
Thanks, Heather. So we have the next question is from Tim Bokelhide at Brown University, asking, for community engagement projects, can you give an example of how one will determine to be biomedical or non-biomedical, i.e., what criteria are used to make this assignment for community engagement projects? So community engagement projects are another area that's kind of a new area for the program this year. And so I don't think that we actually have criteria, written criteria on how you make this assignment. But I think that you have to look at the kind of the maybe the preponderance of the evidence or what the overall goal and intent is. And it's really going to be your call to decide whether it's biomedical, whether you want to call it biomedical or non-biomedical. But you have to look at what the overriding theme and the intent of your project would be certainly we can talk a little bit more specifically about the details of that. But again, it rests with you to make the decision and then do a nice job of justifying where you're coming from and why you think that this is really fit into being a biomedical or non-biomedical. We feel like you're probably talking about something that's in the gray zone here, because I think a lot of examples I can think of would be really clearly one side or the other. I hope that that was some help, as it's still a little bit vague. I think that we have another question here that maybe goes to Leroy. Does a letter of intent have to list external advisory committee members? This is from Trevor Penning at University of Pennsylvania. Do you want it?
If for continuations, yes, go ahead and put the EAC down. For new applications, we just basically, you don't actually put people down. But for continual applications, yes. Renewals, yes. Not for new applications. We just want areas of expertise that you're seeking.
Okay, thank you. I think there's another one here that has to do with the research translation plan. So this came from Laurie Rarden at Dartmouth College, asking, not certain what the slide number was for this one, but the translation plan for each project is part of the RTC section 12 pages, or as part of each research project and their research sharing plan. So the research translation, the research sharing plan is not specific to the research translation core. So you do not need to include it in, for that core, but the project, the research, is that right? They need the research sharing plan. And we are encouraging that there be research translation in the different projects. So if you feel it's appropriate, then it would go in your in the projects, the information that you provide about the projects themselves. But again, keep in mind that this is a plan, and it would not necessarily have to be included in a research sharing plan. So I think, and the other part of this question might be, is it included within the 12 pages section of your research of your research project, if you were including it? And that doesn't go against the 12 pages, does it?
Well, right. So the resource sharing plan comes after the research strategy, and it is not a part of a 12 pages for the project or course.
Okay.
Is that, yeah, that one paragraph.
Okay, there's a slide, another question?
There
was NIOSH. Oh, yeah. So the question came in was, do we see NIOSH as a Superfund research program stakeholder? And I think that it depends upon how you identify what your defined stakeholder. Some not certain the context, but NIOSH has been, for a long time, we've considered them a partner, and we've had an interagency agreement with them to do training. And so we've not seen them quite to be the same sort of stakeholder as EPA and ATSDR, where we've had both EPA and ATSDR have Superfund mandates like we do, so NIOSH is a little different, but not to, can you see in context of how you'd consider them a stakeholder?
I can, this is Danielle Carlin. I can certainly see them as maybe partnering on some of the research projects if maybe some of their technologies that they use or their expertise might be applicable to a particular project. But again, you know, we're interested in environmental problems and not occupational problems. So that's where I can see them being utilized.
jump in a little bit?
Yeah.
Okay. It's an interesting question because it does bring up the issue of environmental exposures versus occupational exposures. That said, this is a research program, and I think that if the research is going to address a concern or a problem associated with a particular exposure, I don't really make a distinction between what the population is, frankly. Let's keep in mind that this is a program that focuses on public health, and therefore I don't see a real problem with it. I think that you probably make sure that you have to have your ducks in a row to see how they're going to be able to use this information in a meaningful way. That's all.
Thanks, Dr. Spoke. So at this time, let's go to the phone line and see if any questions have come up. We are still getting questions online, but we'd like to take a turn with anyone waiting on the phone. In order to take your phone off mute, it is *7. So when you take your phone off mute, state your name, your university, or your organization, and let us know your question.
Dr. Carbone at University of Hawaii Cancer Center.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Morning. Good morning. Actually, good afternoon over there.
Aloha.
Aloha. Can our colleagues at EPA, UCGS, even at NIHS, be co-investigator in the grant or have a role in the grant? And if the answer were to be no, can they have any role in the grant?
How many people want to feel that one? NIH has some very strict guidelines with regards to what government laboratories can do in support of research supported by a grant. The bottom line is that you can include them in your application. They need to provide a letter that would say what they're going to do. No U.S. federal funds can be used to support them in any way. It cannot support their laboratory. It cannot support their travel. It cannot support, I think it can support a student.
And supply.
Supplies?
I think
okay, supplies and a student, and that's pretty much it. When you get down that road, let's go ahead and we can send you the website from NIH as to the guidelines. They're very strict about that. So I hope that answers your question. You can collaborate.
Excuse me. Can institutional support, not grants from the Superfund, but could be indicated that institutional support will cover, for example, for travel or for other activities that cannot be covered through the Superfund? For institutional support, I mean either the institutional support of the institution that submits the grant or fundraising that can come from the community, from other non-profit. Can we, in fact, integrate whatever the funding is with the P42 with other funds if, in fact, that is needed?
If you're talking about can the university use non-U.S. federal funds to leverage and get more bang for the research dollar, yeah, sure, knock yourself out. But the point is that you're going to, on your application, you're going to be able, if you say you're going to put in a particular project, for example, and it's going to cost $200,000, of which $100,000 is going to be covered by the university, I think you need to be able to justify those costs in both categories so that the reviewers know that what you're planning on doing can be done with the resources available. Okay?
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
Hi, may I ask a question?
Absolutely.
Okay. My name is Jennifer George. I'm an independent consulting representative in Trico Environmental Services. So I am representing the technology developers, and I'm just curious how we would, as a technology holder, connect with people who wanted to research in a particular area so that we could work together with them? How would we do that?
I don't want to monopolize the conversation.
So let me just clarify. Yeah. So you mean through the Centre grants. Is that correct?
Through the grants. If you have a technology that requires a large amount of research in order to move it forward, is it possible, A, to do it, or, and if it is possible, how do we connect with the people who have similar interests in that same area?
Okay.
And the expertise to do these grants, obviously.
Yeah, no, that's a good question.
Yeah.
You know, what you're referring to essentially is the Valley of Death, and how do you move things through there in order to have a product that can be usable for a larger audience,
correct,
without breaking the bank. And the best answer I can give you on this is one of the intents of the research translation cores within each of these centers program has an element that talks about technology transfer. The intent here is to be able to work with the vice president for research or what have you's office that usually houses the technology transfer officer and move it forward. It is our intention here as we begin to pull information from the different projects to put it on the web. Everything that we do in this program that is not proprietary is on the web, is on our website. And I would say that the sort of the short answer or the easy answer is for you to continually look at our website and to process things and to get a better idea. The long answer really is for you to become more engaged and for your organizations and organizations like yours to become more engaged with some of the potential products that are coming out of this program. And that requires knowing where we're going to have meetings, where we're going to have workshops, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's
right. Yeah. Is there a way to proactively perhaps like put a paragraph, and I'm not just talking about my own technology, like other technologies, to put a paragraph on your site to say that you are a technology, that's the technology, and you're interested in finding research partners?
We do a lot of matchmaking.
I guess that's what it is.
If you have like a particular, like if you have a website or kind of a scope of the kind of research that you're doing, then we can for sure through our research translation cores,
right,
try to find people who are currently working on projects that are similar.
Right.
Okay.
And I can do the same for the SBIR and NCTR who come up. So I think maybe we could talk offline about that.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
I think you're making an excellent point, because what we're trying to do, what we would like to do on our website, is to sort of do eHarmony for tech transfer.
there you go. Give me a date.
Talk to us offline. That'll be good.
Okay, no problem.
Jennifer, if you can submit a question, then we can get your.
I couldn't find the way to submit a question, but I do have your emails here on the presentation, so what about if I just email you directly, Pepper?
Yes, thanks, Jeff.
Okay, thank you.
Somebody please explain this question.
Can we ask clarification on this question?
Well, we did get a question from Catherine Mashburn from Vanderbilt University, and if Catherine is on the line, Maybe she can give us a little more expound on her question. But the question that we have is that if there's a significant potential biomedical application for a non-biomedical project or technology, she wondered if this would be considered a strength, assuming that the non-biomedical project is not centered on a biomedical project. Her example is about a remediation technology may also be used down the road to ascertain exposure levels in tissues. And I just wonder if Catherine is on the line and would like to expound on that a little bit. And if you are, you press *7 to unmute your line.
But in the meantime, this is Beth. I think that what ultimately happens, though, is each project is reviewed individually,
and is considered to what its merits, scientific merits are. And so even though on the program side of things, we might have give more weight to something that we see having application in the biomedical field, it's got a first pass muster with its scientific review group. It has to be a viable, legitimate project with, and it will be based on its merits.
She's taking it from the actual center. That center is actually what I think her issue was. Overall arching thing is not.
Here's a clarification.
I was afraid to mention
The clarification is, in consulting with NIEHS, many of our collaborators are afraid to mention a biomedical application for a non-biomedical project, mainly due to semantics. Lost the question here, mainly due to semantics. I tend to think that it's a mistake, but I wanted clarification.
Yeah, and I think that goes to the heart of a very frequently asked question, and that's whether something is biomedical or non-biomedical. And that's kind of why an investigator who has, if a center needs to establish two non-biomedical projects, they're a little reluctant, since that's the bare minimum, they're a little bit reluctant to talk about all of the all of the biomedical merits of the same technology.
Right.
And it is certainly a gray area, and it's something that we don't want our applicants or potential applicants to be afraid, but we do really want you to contact us and ask us your questions. If it's a engineering or chemistry or in certain cases, biochemistry-related approach, and you're developing the technology, and you're in the technology development stage, it's often very clearly a non-biomedical project. Sometimes in later iterations of that project, like when you come in for resubmission, you might actually be ready to apply that technology on living systems and on living tissues. And if that's the case, you might actually be moving away from a non-biomedical project towards what would be considered a biomedical project in a later resubmission or something like that. And that has certainly happened in the program. But we encourage you to contact us because it is certainly a nuance. And
right.
We like to get as much feedback from all of our staff here about how to negotiate the non-biomedical and biomedical classification. In cases like that, especially. Are there any other questions on the phone? If there are, you can. You can hit *7. Hello.
Yeah, here it is, right there. Yep. Yeah,
they do. Okay, the question that came in is, I have a question regarding the Research Translation Corps encouraging partnerships with government agencies. Slide 20. Will research translation partnerships with state EPA agencies also be considered a priority? This question came from Jenny Sparrow. And the answer to your question is, that it's yes, it's perfectly legitimate to partner with state agencies. We encourage that. Right now we have a lot of examples of this sort of partnerships and activities going on in our programs. So. Thank you.
Again, *7 if you're on the phone lines and you want to ask a question.
I think we've covered all the ones that have come in online, so we're waiting for any more online or on the phone. We'll sit here patiently for a minute or two while you collect your thoughts. So go back and remind you to questions for either Leroy in Scientific Review or Lisa in Grants Management. They're both here in the room with us, prepared to answer questions. Oh. Of course, you can, as Heather mentioned before, program staff are available to answer questions. If we didn't cover your questions adequately, you have additional questions, or you think of something tomorrow or tonight or after the fact, you can certainly contact us.
You know,
can you, Kim? Can you?
Huh?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Thank you. A quick question from Hawaii. In the training component, you indicated that that was for postdoctoral fellow or trainees. Are you looking for people who work in somebody's lab, or are you looking for people who get some type of startup grant to develop their own ideas?
It's an interesting question. Really, you know, the goal, again, of the training course is to really try to establish some of that interdisciplinary we got some other talk going on at this moment, but really trying to, you know, maintain that goal of being as interdisciplinary as possible. And so, you know, it's nice when the trainees can go off eventually, whether it be postdocs or graduate students, and write their own grants. And but that's not to say that, you know, I would say if you could use that as an example, you know, for, let's say you have a postdoc that is in the midst of wanting to write maybe their own R01 eventually, you know, you can say as an accomplishment, this is what you're promoting your postdocs and your graduate students to do. If they want to take the research in their own direction and eventually write a grant of their own, I don't see any harm in that. But really the training cords themselves it's a way to really try to establish some professional development for your graduate students and your postdocs. That's the whole idea. I mean, ultimately, we want to get these people a job, and in any way possible, as a training corps can help, that's really what I think you should strive for in your application. Any other comments?
No. Yeah, I just have one comment. That's sort of, you know, it was mentioned before, and it's been mentioned over a few times, about we can't require a letter of intent. Two things. One, it's important for the folks out there to contact program staff or grants management staff or even review staff as this process is going forward. If you put in a letter of intent and you're clearly off the mark, we're going to let you know. These applications are a lot of work for you to put together, and you want to make sure that you're at least trying to hit the target, okay? And so I suggest that as you go through this, as you look at these slides again, that you continue to contact us, but that you do give some thought to a letter of intent. It not only helps program staff, but it'll also help review staff to begin the process of lining up appropriate reviewers, which is really very important for the lifeblood of this program. Anyway, that's all I have to say.
Let's see. Another question? Are combined sewage overflow events of interest to this program? And sewage is not part of our mandate for hazardous substance waste. So that would not be a priority. I have one other tip I wanted to add, again, as we wait a few more minutes for other questions to come in. Wanted to point out, if you are, reiterate a point that Heather's kind of covered, is that if you put that Project 2 is collaborating with Project 3 in your research plan, be sure to also include in Project 3, recognize that you're collaborating with Project 2. In other words, be internally consistent and reiterate what is said in each other's projects. We have seen instances where it looks like there's a disconnect. Somebody's one project's planning to collaborate with another project, but there's no evidence that other project knows anything about it. So just a trap that I wanted to advise you to avoid. I mean, the same thing could be said about Research Translation Corps. If you're doing research translation within different projects, research projects, which we now are encouraging, to be certain to not only talk about it in that project, but talk about it in the Research Translation Corps, so that we know that you've got a coordinated effort that has communication going both ways. So that was my tip. And I'll turn it back to anyone on the phone. Care to have another question?
Will the transcript be generated from this and be identified and put up on the web?
Yeah, last year we posted our questions, and any questions that come in offline, you know, if we happen to miss your call, or if we happen to miss, shut down the call before we get to your question, we'll post. It will also be included.
When would that take place?
Within a week.
Okay.
Leroy, do you have any other parting words?
No, I'm good.
You're good.
If they have any questions, email me.
Okay. Lisa, I'm good.
Don't forget the contact information is on slide 10. That's Heather's contact if you have any questions that you think of later.
Yep. And there's another one.
Another question came in?
No, just another contact page on 50 also has.
Page 50.
Yeah.
They have access to
the slide. Mm-hmm. And so as just final remarks, again, we'd like to really thank all of you for your attention. We were really pleased to see so many people register for this webinar, and we want to make sure that you know that the website on which you got the registration link will stay active. And so on that website, we will post additional information, which will include the question and answers, but then also all the links that are contained within this document. We will post that on the additional resources page associated with this webinar. But then also we encourage you to look at the SRP website, where we will post all the information related to this webinar as well. That's going to be located on our webinar webpage. So at this point, I think Beth wanted to say.
Well, I don't know. I wanted to remind people about the evaluation, and maybe that's where you were going with us, that we have an evaluation for this, and we're interested in feedback on any level, including technical problems, if you found had trouble hearing or if there were technical difficulties that we need to be aware of. You can include those in our evaluation. We're certainly interested in content question evaluation, too. So just wanted to. And is that on slide 52? Is that the evaluation? Is that listed on slide 52? Okay. So I think you can lead directly.
Okay. Interrupt. Well, with that, we thank everybody on the phone lines and everybody in the room and Justin for doing the moderating for this phone call. So. At this point, we'll just say goodbye and wish you good luck.
Thanks. Bye.